Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On a Monday, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program on this MLK Day of Service. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a son of the South, Atlanta, Georgia, to be precise. When he was 19, he graduated college and headed north to Crozier Theological Seminary in Upland. It was the beginning of a long relationship between King and the Philadelphia region.
King's time here exposed him to new ideas, providing a foundation for his philosophy and for his life's work. In later years, he'd return to put those ideas into action. So today on the show, an exploration of Philadelphia's influence on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our guide is Lynn Washington, an investigative journalist and a professor of journalism at Temple University. Lynn has spent years studying and writing about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Lynn, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
And so first, we wanted to know about your interest in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, you have been studying this man for how long?
Before I had gray hairs. No, actually, it was in the probably the early 80s. And as irony would have it, my first introduction to King in Philadelphia took place with a street corner conversation about three blocks from here.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
What was that conversation?
A very brilliant historian, but not with a PhD, a guy named James Spady. Saw him on the street one day, and we just got to talking, because whenever you saw Spady, it was going to be a long conversation. So he was talking about this and that, and then it was, oh, and by the way, Dr. King's first protest was here in the Philadelphia area. And it's like, oh, yeah, right. And he laid it out, and it was actually in Maple Shade, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And that sparked my interest. And at the time, I was working with the Philadelphia Daily News. So, you know, every year around this time, you know, what are we going to do for King? And I said, well, why don't we take a look at his time in the Philadelphia area? And that started a big plunge into looking at King.
And you're still plunging today.
Yeah.
It's a pretty deep rabbit hole. It goes back to the 1940s. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., before he got his PhD, before he was a doctor, he was a 19-year-old. He was entering the Crozier Seminary here in our region. Take us to that time. Who was King then, and why did he come here?
Well, he came here to go to seminary school. There was a seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania. It subsequently moved to Rochester, New York. But he came there. He came there with one of his friends from Morehouse, a guy named Walter McCall. And while here, let me back it up a little bit. Even before he came here, there was family connections. His father was, you know, very important and well-known Baptist minister, and he was tied in with many Baptist ministers here in the city, including the father of what turned out to be Congressman William Gray, a city councilman named Marshall Lorenzo Shepherd. And Dr. King was friends with them. Well, not them, but their children, and particularly Marshall Lorenzo Shepherd Jr., who became a minister also and had a church in West Philadelphia. So from time to time in the summer, you know, King would come in and, you know, hang out with his friends. And then when he got here in seminary, he went to the University of Pennsylvania, took some classes. He would hang out in Camden because his fellow seminarian, Walter McCall, their family lived in Camden. So they were, you know, come and hang out. He partied here in Philadelphia.
Was basically a young man.
Yeah,
here.
Well, he was a young
sowing
man.
Sowing his oats and all
yeah,
those things.
Right, yeah. Let me say this, because I'm sure this counters the image that the King family wants to put out, but the ladies love King, and King loved the ladies.
He's like 19 years old when he gets here.
Yeah, he was a young man. Right, yeah.
Was it strange or you know, not strange for him to come to a Baptist seminary in the North, being that he's from Atlanta and he had gotten his bachelor's at Morehouse?
Right. Well, I don't know what the motivation that brought him here, if that was the only one that accepted him or whatever, but he came here, and it was really eye-opening for him in a number of ways.
Yeah.
Prior to him coming here to Philadelphia, he had spent a couple of summers in Connecticut, where he was working on a tobacco farm.
Wow.
Because they grew tobacco in Connecticut. And that was his first time really interacting in an integrated situation, because coming out of Atlanta.
Very segregated.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's very segregated. I mean, that was the time of American apartheid. And we so conveniently want to forget that past.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me as I was doing some research for this conversation was that his time in Philadelphia was where he was first introduced to the teachings of Gandhi, which became very critical and significant in him developing his philosophy of nonviolence. Can you tell, how did he get introduced to that part?
Well, his actual adoption, a formal adoption of the Gandhian principles, came when he attended a lecture at a church probably about 20 blocks from here, First Unitarian Church on Chestnut Street.
Mm-hmm.
A very prominent speaker back in those period, a man named Mordecai Johnson. He was the president of Harvard University. I mean, I'm not Harvard, but Howard.
Yeah. Is
the Black Harvard. It's a HBCU. And Mr. Johnson was really enamored with Gandhi, because they felt that the Gandhi principles, type of activism could be effective in breaking down the apartheid in America. What doesn't get much attention is that there was a lot of interaction between some Black leaders in America and Gandhi himself and in the Gandhi movement. So Mordecai Johnson delivered a lecture in November of 1950 at the Unitarian Church. King attended it. It was sponsored by an organization called the Fellowship House. And Dr. King, in his first autobiography, I think it's called Stride Towards Freedom, he noted how hearing that electrified him so much that he went out and bought 6 books on Gandhi. And when you read his autobiography, he said he was really searching for an effective strategy to utilize to attack the structural inequities in America.
So at that point, at that point in 1950, this is late 1950, King has a sense of, I want to do social justice work. Mm-hmm. I want to dismantle American apartheid.
Right.
He doesn't quite know how he wants to go about that yet, but he goes to this lecture in late 1950 in Philadelphia, and that's sort of the thunderbolt moment for him.
Well, it was a long thunderbolt, one that lasted a couple of months, because we have to remember that attending that lecture was after he actually staged his first formal protest, which took place in June 11th, 1950.
And talk about that, because that was his first real, I guess, clash with act of discrimination. It took place in Maple Shade, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. You sort of talked about this. He and his friend went to Mary's Cafe. Tell us the story.
Well, the story that is incredibly, the story that's in all of the history books, and again, incredibly, King's time in Philadelphia, both during the seminary and subsequent to that, takes up just a few lines in all of these biographies on him, including Pulitzer Prize-winning biographies. King, when he was with McCall, and I work with a guy named Patrick Duff, and he's done a lot of research on this and done a lot of good work. And it looks like in early 1950, King and McCall tried to desegregate a bowling alley in Philadelphia. I mean, in Camden.
Huh.
That didn't go too well. So
what do we know about that?
Very little. Patrick, in interviewing people who knew King at the time, who were residents in the house that McCall stayed in, his relatives, they just blurted that out one day, and I was like, what? But as it turned out, the segregation of bowling was a real flashpoint in the early the ongoing civil rights movement. So let's go to Maple Shade. King decided that he needed to do something to address this discrimination. He knew that there was problems with discrimination. He knew that Maple Shade was, shall we say, well, the Klan used to parade through Maple Shade. Mm-hmm. So he decided that he was going to go to this cafe, Mary's Cafe, and see what he can do in terms of desegregation. So it was King, McCall, McCall's date at the time, a woman named Pearl Smith, and then her roommate, a woman named Doris Wilson. They go there, they ask to, you know, get some beer. It's on a Sunday night, and the bar owner, restaurant owner, a guy named Nichols, he said, no, he's not going to have it.
They knew they were going to be rejected? Was that part of
the
plan?
They probably thought so, because the family, the relatives of McCall, they had a conversation that night before they went up there at in Camden at their house at 753 Walnut Street. And they were trying to dissuade King from going up there because they said, it's not going to be nothing but trouble. And he says, we got to get this thing straightened out. We're going up there. And that's when he went up there, and they were denied service. At one point, when they couldn't get the beer, they said, well, can we get some ginger ale? And the bar owner says, no, you know, get out of here. And the bar owner thought that they were trying to set him up in some kind of way. Mm-hmm. So he goes and gets a gun and, you know, said, you know, I killed for less. And he shoots the gun outdoors, and they left. They immediately go to the Maple Shade police station and report him. And that led to King's first lawsuit against discrimination. King knew that New Jersey was the first state in the union that actually passed a law that barred discrimination in public accommodations, and they used that law. And, I mean, it's really a fascinating story when we look at all that was going on in Jersey at the time. That night when he was at the police station, the head of Camden County's NAACP, a man named Dr. Ulysses Wiggins from Camden, actually went to Maple Shade and straighten things out. The lawsuit was filed by an associate of Wiggins, a guy named Burke Johnson, who was a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's law school.
Wow.
And Burke Johnson, actually, when he was at the law school, he was the head of the law review there. And there was a young black woman who wanted to go on to the law review. The dean didn't want to have it. No women, and particularly no colored girl. And that colored girl turned out to be Sadie Alexander.
Who's a statue.
And of course, a school named after her. Right next to Penn's Camp.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Way to loop that all together.
And that's just the beginning of that loop.
So 1950 is a big year.
Oh, it was a big year.
I mean, it sounds like a year of awakening for him.
Right.
He has this action in Maple Shade, New Jersey. He goes to this lecture in Philadelphia. And you see this convergence coming between, I'm going to do something about racial injustice in America, and I'm going to use nonviolence as my primary tool. I mean, it sounds like 1950. A lot is happening in the mind of a young Dr. Martin Luther King.
Very pivotal year. Because of that that incident in Maple Shade, and it didn't quite work out too well, because the lawsuit didn't go as far as King wanted it to go, so he saw that there were some, let's say, difficulties with using that, and that's in part why he went to hear the lecture, because he was searching, trying to get some more information, and when he heard Gandhi's principles, it's not that he was unaware of Gandhi's principles, because he had studied Gandhi, he had studied other people, he had studied communism, studied Marxism, and he felt that Gandhi had the best approach, and that's how he started adopting that. And as it turned out, years later, I think it was 1959, King actually went to India for 4 weeks, and it was sponsored by the Quaker organization here in Philadelphia.
American Friends Service Committee.
Yeah. And it was a man and his wife from Philadelphia, Jim Bristol, who actually took him around while he was in India.
And it's so interesting because he wrote an article in 1958 called My Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, and he specifically refers to his years in the greater Philadelphia area as a time when he began a serious intellectual quest for a method to eliminate social evil. So this was a really formative time for King.
Right. So what happened in Maple Shade, or more specifically what didn't happen, led to him trying to think a little bit deeper on how to get something.
Yeah, lawsuits aren't going to cut it. I need some other method. And then sort of Gandhi comes on his horizon. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about the formation of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. here in our region. And then on the other side of this break, we're also going to talk, Lynn, about how he starts to put some of those principles into action in later years, including in some pretty big cases you might remember set right here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Lynn Washington about the Philadelphia years and the Philadelphia roots of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Lynn is an investigative journalist and professor of journalism at Temple University. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we've been talking about the connection between Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the place that we all call home, Philadelphia.
With us in studio is Lynn Washington, investigative journalist and a professor of journalism at Temple University. Lynn, so happy to have you this hour.
It's good to be able to talk about this story because it just gets short shrift, again, in all these massive, in multiple biographies on King. You know, you sit in a library, and I remember a couple of years ago, I was down at the University of Delaware library in the summer. And it was almost scary because nobody was in there. But I'm looking through all these books and I'm trying to find, because somebody's going to have this story. And nobody had the story.
And by the way, the story you're talking about before the break, we were talking about how Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to Philadelphia region as a 19-year-old to go to seminary. He spent time in Camden, New Jersey. And this is the place where he was really started putting two and two together, exposed to the teachings of Gandhi, and actually filed his first civil rights lawsuit after trying to integrate a place or try to spark do nonviolent protest at Mary's Cafe in Camden. And so we're in the 1950s at this point with Dr. King. And I wanted people to kind of understand what was going on in Philadelphia at that time, because Philadelphia had prominent Black families as well. There was a burgeoning civil rights movement here as well. And then kind of talk about how what was happening here may have influenced King as well, because he had a lot of relationships with folks who were already here, very well connected in the city.
Well, there's an account in some of the biographies on King where he was in Philadelphia, in Center City, Philadelphia, having a meal with one of his friends, not McCall. And the food came out slowly. They complained about it. When the food came back, it had sand in it. But there wasn't any legal mechanism that he could use, because Pennsylvania didn't have a law like New Jersey had. And that law that New Jersey initially passed in 1945 was introduced by the second Negro to sit in New Jersey's legislature. King had some experiences here before he started, you know, moving on to, you know, Camden and Maple Shade and other places. And that incident in Maple Shade was very important to him, so much so that he asked his mother to postpone his brother's wedding so he could attend a court proceeding. So for those who want to say, oh, this is just a blip, it wasn't any big deal. Well, if it wasn't such a big deal, then he would have been in Atlanta at the wedding versus up here. And the family relented, postponed the wedding, and King and his sister trying to get back there in time for the rescheduled, he actually got a speeding ticket.
Wow.
I think it was either in Delaware or in Maryland, you know, trying to get back down south to attend the postponed wedding.
When King came to Crozier to get his Bachelor of Divinity, was it known to him, was it known to his family that this was part of a path that he was building toward a social justice movement or some sort of life in a social justice movement? Or was that still a developing idea for him and his family? I'm just imagining, you know, his dad, his mom sending him up here to Chester. Are they thinking, look, he's just going to go to divinity school? Or are they thinking, he's also there in part because of the social justice work he wants to do.
I would say that when he came here, the expectation of his parents, and I guess initially him, was that he would just be a good minister.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was going to follow
find a flock somewhere,
in his father's footsteps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, in Chester, there was a minister named Pius Barber, mm-hmm. who was the first Negro to graduate from the Crozier Seminary. And he would take people under his wing who went there. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Barber also knew King and his family. So he took King under his wing. And as it turned out, Reverend Barber was he was an activist.
Yeah.
And he, was police brutality, housing discrimination, all sorts. He was challenging all of that. So there was a lot of very vigorous conversations. Mm-hmm. Between King and Reverend Barber over some good meals that the Barber's wife would cook for them.
So this seemed like these were very formative years, mm-hmm. that King spent in the Philadelphia region, really learning how to become an activist, really cutting his teeth mm-hmm. at nonviolent protests, really solidifying some of the philosophies that he was taking on. And that relationship sort of continued because he developed relationships. I know he was good friends with Bill Gray. Mm-hmm. He would come back and preach at Bright Hope Baptist Church. What did those visits back and forth to Philadelphia look like once he sort of like started executing on this vision that he had developed?
Well, those who knew him, people like the late C. Dolores Tucker, she said that that Philadelphia was like a second home to King. He came here as a part of his movement and trying to expand the movement. When he, near the latter year of his life, when he put together the Poor People's Campaign that was going to, have an event, a longstanding event down in Washington, D.C., the first office that in the North was in North Philadelphia. C. Dolores Tucker donated some space in one of the buildings that she owned. He would come here and get donations. So he was in and out of the city quite a bit. He came for the protests at Girard College.
Yeah.
We should probably take a pause there.
We got a pause there. That's a big one.
Right. Dive into that. So let's take folks back to the mid-1960s, mm-hmm. kind of cresting in 1965. What's going on at Girard College? So Girard College, for folks that don't know, is a school established in the 19th century by Stephen Girard, a very wealthy financier, for explicitly white orphaned boys, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's located in North Philadelphia. And in the mid-1960s, there is a movement to desegregate it, right? It take us inside that movement and why it was so significant here in Philadelphia.
Well, we look at Philadelphia as being this Quaker-inspired, genteel city. Reality, racism was like, so thick you could cut it with a knife. There was a lot of support for the Confederacy here in Philadelphia. Where we are right now today, back in the 1830s, there was a place called Pennsylvania Hall that abolitionists built. And within days of the building opening, anti-abolitionists burned the place to the ground.
Yeah.
And as so often happens in racist incidents, the account said that the mob that burned the building was made up of gentlemen of standing and wealth. But when the grand jury got involved in it, nobody knew anybody.
Yeah.
So Philadelphia was a very racist place, and it didn't end in the 19th century. It went into the 20th century. The effort to desegregate Girard College, from my understanding, actually began back in the 50s. There were mm-hmm. legal actions. Sadie Alexander's husband, Raymond Pace Alexander, was trying to do some things in terms of court, trying to take some action.
And it was complicated because he had in his will, or he had bequeathed
mm-hmm. Girard,
the Girard College, which, by the way, for folks who don't understand, it's not a bachelor's college. It's for secondary school.
Yeah, secondary.
Mm-hmm. But it was difficult in part because Girard had wanted it to be for white boys, right?
That's right, yeah. And the entity that actually oversaw it, and I think still to today, was a collection of judges in Philadelphia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of legal entanglements. And when the legal action, when the court action was just moving too slowly, a gentleman named Cecil B. Moore gets involved.
Yeah.
And that's when you started having direct action. And King came in for that. But
and Cecil. Let's talk about Cecil B. Moore. Because Cecil B. Moore, famed lawyer here, also the head of the NAACP at the time, had a different sort of philosophy than King, who was very nonviolent. He was a little bit more militant. And he wasn't necessarily very welcoming to King at the time. Can you talk about their relationship, about Cecil B. Moore, who he was, and the differences between him and King at this time?
Well, there was, let's just say, a difference in approach. Like you said, Cecil was a little more militant than King, a little more rooted in direct action, not turn the other cheek. But also there was a little ego there, too.
You know, because he was the big civil rights.
He was the big civil rights. This is my city. And this carpetbagger, he called King a carpetbagger, is not going to come into the city. And there was one time when King came in, and I think it was like 1965. And it was announced, Martin Luther King's going to come here. And Cecil, oh, no, he's not. And he's not going to do this. And they finally relented, worked things out. And within 24-hour notice, it came up, well, King's going to be in West Philadelphia. He's going to be in North Philadelphia. He's going to be here. When he was in West Philadelphia at 40th and Haverford and Lancaster, where they all come together, 10,000 people showed up.
Wow.
In North Philadelphia, I think about 5,000 people showed up. And he was at the wall. Because Girard College has a wall around it, and part of Cecil's Cecil Moore's demonstrations, they would have people march around the wall, and there was a police commissioner in Philadelphia at the time named Frank Rizzo, who you know could have been a, a descendant of Bull Connor from down south, and when the people would be marching peacefully, you know, but vigorously. Rizzo would have motorcycle cops drive their motorcycles down the street, knocking people over. So there was a lot of tension there. But they had a, shall we say, a rocky relationship, but it ultimately broke down to they both saw the need to try to work together because the overall goal was much bigger than their respective perceptions of themselves.
Or their egos. I want to read this quote from King. You mentioned that wall. There is, like, if you go there in North Philadelphia, there is a literal wall around Girard College, still is today. And King said, it is a sad experience at this stage of the 20th century to have to stand in the city that has been known as the cradle of liberty, that has in its midst and in its presence a kind of Berlin Wall to keep the colored children of God out. Why was it important enough for King to come here and to speak on this issue, given that so much of his work was in the South? Is he starting to turn his gaze northward by 1965?
Well, by 65, he's definitely turned his gaze northward. You know, as we know, when he goes into Chicago, you know, he gets hit with a brick, you know, in one of the near-end suburbs in Chicago. And he saw that the inequities and discrimination in the North were much more entrenched than in the South. You know, down South, I mean, the biggest racist in town could be your great, your good buddy, you know, slap you on the back, but you had to follow a line. In the North, they would, you know, smile you in the face and stab you in the back. So he, by the mid 60s, he was trying to expand the issue of civil rights. And this was a very clear and dramatic one, where we had this institution right in the middle of a largely then black neighborhood. It's all gentrified now. Well, not all, but almost all. And he just incorporated that in there. Plus, he had people in Philadelphia said, hey, you need to come here. We need you to help elevate
this issue. So he's trying to make this case, not just to Philadelphia, but to the country.
A national issue.
The work that you've been seeing me do in the South these many years, that's not the only work to be done.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and I wonder, because we talk about 1965 and the Girard College desegregation effort, but Philadelphia people from here were big supporters of King. And I read that in when there was the March on Washington, the largest contingency of folks came from Philadelphia. And how big of a support, like as far as fundraising, like how big of a of, you know, an impact of Philadelphia residents, the leaders here, the institutions here, because Philadelphia has this long history as far as African Americans being free people and having power in institutions. How big of a deal were those institutions to King and his efforts?
Well, they would help fund him. They would give him, you know, moral support. I'm sure there was some, technical assistance, you know, because, you know, collective minds being together. But he was really dedicated to efforts to try to change the system. If we can flip back to like 1950, Reverend Pius Barber's daughter, a woman named Elmanina Barber, she became the second black female lawyer in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. She succeeded after Sadie Alexander. Elmanina's son was very sick, and long story short, she got beat up by police in Chester. And they took the police officer to court, and Reverend Barber organized a whole bunch of folks. They came there, and one of the persons that came to provide moral support for Elmanina Barber was a young seminarian named Mike King. Hmm. He was Mike King before he was Martin Luther.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. Mike.
Mike. Wow. Yeah. And, I mean, there's newspaper articles on this. This is not, you know, people talking. So this was a long effort for him. So Philadelphia really, you know, helped out.
Had this mutual relationship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you talk about Philadelphia and its activism. I mean, it really goes back to the founding of the country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first petition sent to Congress asking for a gradual elimination of slavery came from black Philadelphians in 1799. Mm. Mm-hmm. They also were requesting an end to the practice of kidnapping free blacks and taking them back into slavery. Mm-hmm. And remember, at that time, Philadelphia was the nation's capital. So Congress was meeting over at what was then the State House, you know, the building right there on Chestnut Street between 5th and 6th Street. And that petition just got thrown out. Mm. When you read the congressional record, there was one congressperson from South Carolina and said, you know, thank God for slavery. Well, you would expect that from South Carolina. But there was a congressman from Rhode Island who said we should disapprove of this insulting petition because we all know that Negroes can't write. Mm. But the petition was written by Absalom Jones, black minister here in Philadelphia.
Well, it's the duality of Philadelphia that you have both this long history of activism and striving, but then also this entrenched racism that you described. I'm curious what you think, if you had to guess, King made of that when he was living here as a young person. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is his first prolonged period of time living in a somewhat integrated society. Mm-hmm. Crozier was integrated, correct? I mean, he's going to an integrated school, correct? Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious if he took any lessons or any inspiration or any perhaps pessimism away from living in a somewhat integrated world for the first time.
Well, the answer would be yes. I mean, you know, he had that kind of experience
in Connecticut, yeah,
where he was immediately there was, you know, like a kumbaya, but you walk off the farm, or you walk away from that, you know, the seminary, Harmony, but you walk into downtown Chester, you're a Negro, and you're discriminated against, and it's, you know, very clear and evident that there are boundaries based on race, segregation, and again, this America was in apartheid at that time.
Yeah.
And we always like to forget all of these things, but both the Nazis and the architect, well, not the architects, but the people who implemented apartheid in South Africa, they justified what they did based on what was going on in America.
Yeah. So interesting. When I think about all that King learned here, as a young man, sort of putting things together, how he came back here. Do you think that there were things that he couldn't have learned anywhere else had he not been in Philadelphia?
I would say yes. I can't give you a chapter and verse on it, but the experience was unique in that there is this persona of, or this perception of Philadelphia being very genteel, being very progressive, the home of democracy. And then when people get here and it just smacks you in the face, it's like, whoa, what is going on here? So, you know, that dichotomy between what you think it is and what it really is, I'm sure that had an impact on him.
Because it seems like he got some of that grit during his formative years here, like having done his first nonviolent action in Camden and then sort of getting introduced to Gandhi's teachings and really taking that all in and then being mentored by Reverend Barber.
Yeah, and also, I mean, he's studying at University of Pennsylvania. He's interacting with a whole lot of people, and that has an impact on him. We look at King, and when we think of King doing something other than civil rights, we look at him, the action that he took against the Vietnam War, what, 67?
Yeah.
However, in 1958, King is in Cape May, New Jersey, speaking at a Quaker convention, and he's equating American segregation with colonialism in Africa and in Asia. In 1962, King issues a call to boycott South Africa because of its apartheid. And he did that in conjunction with the then head of the ANC, a man named Albert Luthuli. It's, you know, this is before Nelson Mandela became the president. Nelson Mandela at that point was on the run because he was a member of the ANC's military wing. So King did a lot of things in terms of equating what's going on overseas with what's happening here.
And a lot of that connects right to our region.
Yeah, right here. So it was the, you know, Quakers and other people, progressive people in the Philadelphia region and in Philadelphia who was schooling him on this.
You mentioned 1967, and King does come back to Philadelphia in October of 1967 as part of the Southern Christian Leadership Freedom Tour. Plays this big event at the Spectrum. I think Sidney Poitier is there, Aretha Franklin, Nipsey Russell. That's a long way from being Mike King in Chester you know, in 1949, 1950. You know, at this point, 1967, I mean, he is of course, a civil rights leader, but also, as you can kind of get a sense there, a celebrity, right? I mean, playing his show at the Spectrum. I'm curious, at that point in time, you know, where King is in terms of his activism. By 67, 68, how far has his philosophy progressed from, you know, the philosophy he embraced back in 49, 50, living here?
I think when you get to the 67, 68 period, he's starting to see a lot of disillusionment.
Yeah.
He felt that the change that he had been fighting for since the mid-50s in a big way should have had more impact. Yes, there was the civil rights law. Yes, there was the voting rights law. But still there was that entrenchment, and particularly when he started coming, you know, further north. So I think that was around the time when he was talking about, when he raised the issue about integrating into a burning house.
Yes, yes.
Is there some value in that?
Well, I will note that when he comes in 67, he also gives a speech, a side speech at Barrett Junior High School in South Philadelphia. And he says, part of that speech, our slogan must not be burn, baby, burn. It must be build, baby, build, organize, baby, organize. Our slogan must be learn, baby, learn, so we can earn, baby, earn.
He was switching to the economic.
He went from civil rights to silver rights, economics. And this is pretty much rooted in the part of the I Have a Dream speech that everybody always forget. Before we get to the dream, he talks about the nightmare, and part of that nightmare was the economic inequities. And by 67, he's thinking about the Poor People's Campaign. And when he's talking about poor people, he's not just talking about poor people in Harlem. He's talking about poor people in the hollows of West Virginia also.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, February of 1968 was King's last trip to Philadelphia. And he was treated by Dr. Walter Lomax. He had laryngitis. And of course, Walter Lomax was a very prominent Philadelphia physician, African-American. And then King died just a few months later.
A few months later. Yeah. What's really interesting about New Jersey Dr. King did his first protest in New Jersey. And the last speech that he gave in the North, 4 days before he was assassinated, was in Paterson, New Jersey. Mm. And that's what's kind of mind-boggling, because Patrick Duff, that I mentioned earlier, has been trying to get a New Jersey State historic recognition of the house that King was in when he planned to go up to Maple Shade. And New Jersey State historic people are resistant to that. Mm. And they've also resisted doing anything about memorializing the actual protest site in Maple Shade. Yeah. There is a marker there, but it was a marker that Patrick Duff was responsible for putting up.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we're going to talk to Patrick on the other side of this break. But first, we have to thank you, Lynn Washington, investigative journalist and a professor of journalism at Temple University. Lynn, thank you so much for your time this hour.
Well, thank you so much, and appreciate your interest in the topic, and appreciate you having me here.
Of course. And when we come back from this next break, we'll hear about the MLK House in Camden, New Jersey, right across the river from where we are right now. We'll discuss the significance of that building and the many efforts to preserve it. Stick with us. We'll be right back on this King Holiday. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Earlier this hour, we talked a lot about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the time he spent in our region. While attending Crozier Theological Seminary, Dr. King spent a lot of his time in Camden, New Jersey. He took residence there from 1948 until 1951.
And over the decades, the house he lived in, located at 753 Walnut Street, became dilapidated due to neglect. There were failed development deals, even vandalism. And in 2024, the house earned an infamous spot on Preservation New Jersey's Most Endangered Sites list.
Our next guest has worked alongside other community leaders and activists to preserve the MLK House in Camden, as well as the history it represents. Patrick Duff, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And so, Patrick, you've been an activist for many years, but you've been specifically advocating for the MLK House in Camden. What really hooked your interest and made you say, you know what, I'm going to advocate for this cause?
Well, I've been an activist in the cannabis community in Los Angeles for really 10 years, from like 2005 to 2015. And there was a lot of techniques and tactics I used in that activism that I took from Dr. King. A lot of the protests, a lot of the peaceful protests, nonviolent activism, almost sit-in type things where when the DEA would come, we'd refuse to leave. And so when I moved back to the Philadelphia area, which was around 2014, I had come across a story that showed that Dr. King's activism started in Maple Shade. And I thought it was kind of odd that I didn't know that, being I grew up two towns away. And when I started to research it more, I realized that it was actually true, that Dr. King was refused service in Maple Shade on June 12th of 1950. So I made it a point to go to Maple Shade's committee and council and requested that they memorialize it in some way. And I remember having a meeting with the solicitor and the one of the council people, and they gave me a challenge. They said, if you want a marker here, you're going to have to prove it happened in Maple Shade and to Dr. King with a primary source document. And at that time, it was October of 2014. And it took me 2.5 months, but on January 15th, on King's birthday, on 2015, I found the police report in an archive that showed Martin Luther King was in fact in Maple Shade, was in fact part of a group of defendants, and also it had his address on it, which was 753 Walnut Street and in Camden, New Jersey. And when I saw that, I said, wait, Martin Luther King in Camden? This is something that I surely had never heard of. And so I went down to the house, saw it was abandoned, had a demolition sign on the house from Hargrove Demolition, and found out who owned the home. A woman named Jeanette Lily Hunt owned the home. And I went to her house, knocked on her door, and I went there with Kelly Francis, who was the ex NAACP leader. And I asked her, I said, very simply, I said, can I ask? I said, did you know Dr. Martin Luther King? And she said, well, he used to live in my house.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Just like that.
One rabbit hole leads to another. So let's rewind a little bit. How did Dr. King come to live in this house? Because presumably he's spending some of his time at seminary in Chester, absolutely, but he's also splitting his time, I guess, living in Camden as well. So why is he even living in Camden?
So his best friend was a man named Walter McCall. Him and McCall actually met in Morehouse. McCall was giving him a haircut for 10 cents. King didn't have the 10 cents in his pocket. Not many people know, but King was sent to college with a checkbook. So he didn't have a lot of cash with him. And them two wound up getting to a wrestling match over the 10 cents and became best friends after that. Walter McCall's cousin lived in, uncle lived in Camden, Jethro Hunt. Mr. Hunt allowed McCall and King to stay there periodically. McCall had to stay there at first because he wasn't able to go to college until a semester after. He actually worked in Camden school districts for a semester to save money so he can go to Crozier with King and then join King the second semester. And a lot of people don't realize this, but at that time, civil rights in the country were absolutely, people were coming back from the war and the military had desegregated. So one of the people that had come back from the war was Jethro Hunt, was Walter McCall's cousin. And they were having a conversation on the stairs outside of 753 Walnut Street, where McCall had just let him know, and King had just let him know, that they were going to go get some sandwiches and maple shade. And Jethro said, absolutely not. You're not going to go there. They don't serve black people. You can't go down there. And King, on the steps of 753 Walnut Street, this is from Jethro Hunt, said that, he said, oh, that's okay. Maybe you think we shouldn't be going there, but maybe we need to go down there so we can start going anywhere that we want.
Yeah.
You know, from there, they, you know, people think that it was some sort of happenstance. Now, they went in there purposefully because they knew they weren't going to be served. It was purposeful because New Jersey had a civil rights legislation that had been passed. What's interesting is it was passed in 1945 by Hill. They called it the Hill Bill. Mm-hmm. He was one of the only African-American assemblymen in New Jersey, second African-American assemblyman. It was then ratified in 1947 in the New Jersey Constitution, but it didn't have an enforcement mechanism. It wasn't till 1949 when a woman, Freeman from Essex County, actually gave it an enforcement mechanism. So in January of 1950 was really the law was able to be used. And one of the first people to use New Jersey's law against not serving people in places of public accommodation was Martin Luther King Jr.
Wow.
And New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection and Historic Preservation Office say that that is not a significant event in history or in the life of Dr. King, the first civil rights battle of Martin Luther King.
Wow. Wow. And I want to, we only have a couple minutes left, but I do want to sort of talk further about this, because this house fell into dilapidation. It was vandalized, falling down. And there was this launch of an effort to save the house and to preserve it. Can you tell us where the house currently stands? What's the situation right now?
Well, in 2023, the house caught fire and it burned it down almost completely, except for the front and the side wall that stood. Pastor Amir Khan, who had basically taken possession of the house in 2021, I think it was, has now since rebuilt the house. It is almost complete. It's going to be used, I believe, as a place for kids to come, like a museum and a learning center for children. And they're going to be building another building next to it as like a museum for the area to learn about it. What's sad is that New Jersey has not embraced this event. And I believe the reason why they haven't is because they don't want to be known for the place that started the civil rights career of Martin Luther King, when most people think it's Montgomery. But the fact is, it was New Jersey's civil rights law that King later asked the federal government to enact that gave us the federal legislation that was passed in 1963. So if it weren't for King's involvement in Maple Shade and what happened in Jersey, who knows if we ever have Dr. King in the latter years.
Well, obviously, we wish you and Mr. Khan the best in bringing this dream to a reality. And we look forward, hopefully someday, to visiting it ourselves. Yes. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and if you want to visit somewhere that's amazing, that just came out last year, the year before, the First Unitarian Church, that's at 21st and Chestnut, is actually the place that he heard Mordecai Johnson's speech that
about
Gandhi. To take up nonviolence.
Yeah, there's so many great... We have to end it there. Patrick Duff, activist, who has been critical in trying to preserve Dr. King's former home in Camden. But there are so many great historical sites all around the region with links to Dr. King. Thank you, Patrick, for your time today.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that address again, 753 Walnut Street in Camden, New Jersey. Got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan for their help putting together today's show. Thanks to our visual producer, Mike Schiffler, Al Banks, and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia on King Day, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.